Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Wonders of the Night Sky, Things You Should See Before You Die by Bob King, known as Astro Bob. And, he definitely has some great English. You know, the way that he can speak is just so beautiful. The way he puts things together. Now, we're up to chapter 22, or the 22nd thing, Jupiter's Great Red Spot. And they've got a shot here from 79 to 2014, which sort of indicates that it's actually shrinking dramatically. There you go. Saturn has rings. Jupiter's got its big red spot. Each is iconic, yet transitory. It's very possible Saturn's ring may have formed as recently as 100 million years ago, when a comet or a small asteroid collided with one of its icy moons. The debris spreading and flattening into a pancake of ringlets we see today. I would find that absolutely fascinating, how the gravity dynamics mean. Does that mean that, half of us flung out to space? I find that interesting. Jupiter's a Great Red Spot, GRS, is nearly as famous as Saturn rings. It has been around since at least the mid-1600s, though not unchanged. You can think of the Great Red Spot as an off-the-charts hurricane with 30 times the size of a typical terrestrial storm, with winds barreling at 644 kilometres an hour. Sandwiched between jet streams blowing in opposite directions, the GRS spins counterclockwise once every 4 to 5 days. Unlike earthly hurricanes, which are low-pressure storms, the red spot is a region of high pressure with clouds that stand high above their neighbours. While one of the reasons for this mammoth storm has lasted so long is that Jupiter has no land for it to crash into and dissipate like a terrestrial storm. Once GRS got rolling, it took a life on its own. If the planet had a chamber of commerce, its slogan might be, "We're all atmosphere all the time." What a beautiful way of doing it. Oh, beautiful pictures of it. The thickest, darkest cloud belt on Jupiter's have a reddish hue, but generally lack the intensity of the GRS. Exactly what causes the spot's colour remains a mystery. Jupiter's atmosphere is primarily made of light gases, hydrogen, helium, with clouds of ammonia, ammonium hydrosulfide, and water blown by the jet streams into parallel cloud belts or bands. Astronomers think cosmic radiation or ultraviolet light from the sun bombards chemically alter the ammonia and acetylene to create new compounds with telltale red hue. Rising from below the cloud deck, they spread over the GRS like a frosting on a cake. When exposed to the light, sunlight and cosmic rays, the frosting turns red. The spot spin confines and concentrates and cooks the gases, maintaining their red colour at least for a time. A long time GRS watchers have seen the colour change over the years, from a pale tan to a peach brick red. In my youth, the spot's brick red hue made it jump right out of small telescopes. 20 years later, the colour is closer to a pale tan. Takes more effort to see. Isn't that amazing? The variation in colour is probably caused by varying amounts of acetylene and ammonia, and the altitude and how they're going and when they're exposed to light spots. That's really interesting. The variation, GRS changes in two other ways. In the late 1800s, it spanned 40,000 kilometres. So that's, our Earth's diameter is 12,000 kilometres. More than three times the diameter of Earth. And it looked like a long hot dog. Since then, it's contracted, become rounder, and now measures only 1.2 Earths across. The shrinkage rate has been ticking up since 2012, making the speculation that the GRS may disappear altogether in a not too distant future. Smaller entities of swirling gases absorbed by the GRS appear to be sapping the energy and may cause the downsizing. Will the GRS swirl away to nothing like as so much as water down the drain? Well, our future sky watchers need to change the name to the GRP. It's a possibility that all the more reason to get a look at the amazing feature while it's still around. Very interesting. Chapter 23, Mars Polar Caps. As a kid, I loved this. It's such a great theme. You see them changing. Funny, Mars lacks Saturn's exotic appeal, but almost equal drawing power because of the sense of a familiar face. Eroded stream beds, buttress, mitzvahs, sandstorms, starry nights and sunny days, and of course, the distinctive polar caps help us to feel a real connection to the planet, red planet. Has the life evolved here and there like it did and continues to do on Earth? Or did it perish or leave only crumbles of bacterial microfossils behind? We may find the answers to the questions and others in the coming decade after a more extensive study of the planet, with probes that will scoop up and return promising rock samples to the lab for study. Until then, we can look and wonder at Mars in our telescopes and try to imagine what it might be like to stand on the dry, rusty, dry surface. Arms extended in receptive gestures as we take the scene around us. Two things stand out when observing Mars through a telescope. Dark features on the surface, called albedo markings, and if we're lucky, one or both solar ice caps. Albedo refers to how much light is reflected on the surface and reflects back to your eye. Since much of Mars is covered in fine iron-rich dust that reflects sunlight well, the planet is a bright pinkish-red appearance. Contrasting with darker features are regions where the dust has been removed by prevailing winds and revealing a typically grey basaltic rock beneath the planet's crusty overcoat. Basalt is volcanic rock that's common on Mars, as it is right here at home. I pass millions of tons of ancient basalt every day on my way to work at northern Minnesota. Polar caps are very deceptive. They mimic the appearance of Earth's frozen extremities, but they're composed of ice, water, and carbon dioxide, dry ice. Mars is plenty colder than Earth because it's about half as far from the sun. The reason ice accumulates on the planet's polar regions, the Earth's average temperature is 16 degrees, while that is Mars is minus 55 degrees, 120 degrees colder. Both caps contain permanent year-round water ice reserves, and a seasonal cap of carbon dioxide ice that forms every fall and winter, then sublimates, goes directly from solid to gas in spring. What a beautiful way of expression. He's just a master. Every fall, in each respective polar region, blustery clouds form and block the growing caps from view. Carbon dioxide ice freezes out of the air and covers the cap with dry ice, snow ice, expanding its size. When spring arrives, about 6 months later, Martian seasons last about twice as long as Earth's. Oh yeah, it takes longer to go. The cloud part of the polar caps gleams brilliant white in sunlight. Even a small 76 millimeter telescope will show the red desert planet cap with a white button. As the season progresses, eaten alive by mosquitoes, the cap shrinks to dry ice, vaporizes directly into the thin atmosphere. Meanwhile, the cap at the other end of the planet, it's now fall, hurtles under a massive blanket of clouds called polar hood, which can be bright enough to make you think you're seeing a true cap. Occasionally, both caps are visible, but usually one is tipped towards the Earth in another way during the times when the two planets are closest. Mars is only a small planet, only about twice as big as the Moon and half the size of Earth. To see features on the surface at their best, sky watchers concentrate their Mars viewing around the time of opposition, when both the Earth and Mars are lined up on the same side of the Sun and closest together. At their nearest, the two planets can be just 55 million kilometers apart. So that's saying that Mars is 200 million kilometers from the Sun. And farthest, they're separated by 140 million. So if they're 200, I don't quite understand. I suppose it's elliptical orbit. Mars' permanent north cap. So if it's 150. So it's, we're at 150 the Sun, and they're saying that it's 150 plus 350 is 400 million kilometres. Now, yeah, I just can't quite see how that works. Happy for Mars viewing, I recommend the modest 152-centimetre or large instrument. Throughout the high school and college, I used a 152 reflecting telescope purchased with paper route money from my grade school days. When Mars was close, I crank up the magnification over 250 and even 350 to eke out every millimeter I could watch the waving and waning of the polar caps. I had names for every features on my fingertips and I could rattle them off like a tour guide. Such are the joys of amateur astronomy. The intense observation of a planet or other sky object can be quickly turn you into a resonant, whatever that means. I'm going to leave that there. The best viewing time, South Cap, is April and July. 2020 is the best viewing time. Now, okay. Okay, so they say the next one is number 24. It's a short one. 8 planets in one night. First off, everyone gets a free planet, yes. Yeah, the very one you're standing on. Earth is always a great place to start. From there, you can look up and see all 7 of our brother, sister, and planets, including... Oh, yeah. Okay, our planets. Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Usually, in this... or that part of the sky. Some are visible during the evening and others before dawn, but rarely they bunch up, so you might see them all together, arrayed across the sky like stepping stones across a river. Each planet orbits the sun at different lengths of time depending on its distance. Saturn, far away, is slow, taking 29.5 years to complete. If you see a ring planet in Virgo 1 year, it will return to the same place 29.5 years later. Jupiter accomplishes the circuits in 12 years. Mars, 687 days. Venus and Mercury orbit between the Earth and the Sun, so they swing back and forth, and once under the Sun, others spending most of their time in the morning and evening twilight. Getting planets together in a confined space is like getting your kids to put down what they're doing and come to the table for dinner. Of course, there's no getting planets to do anything. Instead, we simply have to wait for the diverse orbital periods to fortuitously align and bring them all into view at once. I've done simulations and have listed below 4 times between 2018 and 22 when all 5 planets, naked eye planets, will be visible across the sky. 3 of the dates, Uranus and Neptune, will be out of shot, making the grand total of 8 planets if you included the free beam. To see them all, you need to be reasonably dark sky with a pair of 40 to 50 millimetre binoculars. In all cases, planet Mercury will be near the eastern dawn or western dusk horizon, so find a place with a wide open view, especially in those directions. The last easily visible grand alignment occurred in January 2016, when sky watchers were willing to brave the chill of dawn to pick out 5 planets spread across 110 degrees, 11 fists of the morning sky, west to east, Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, Venus, Mercury. Next grouping, a 4-planet affair, occurs in the late summer 2018. The maps include an arc that runs near all the planets. This is ecliptic, the plane of the Earth's orbit, as a line projected into space and traced out to the sun once a year. And trace out by the sun once a year. Planets travel the same celestial highway, which traverses 12 zodiac constellations as they orbit the sun. Why do they take the same road and never exit onto another? Because the planets essentially orbit in a flat plane, like runners in a track meet. Earth's a runner too. We look across to see how the competition's doing. The other 100 planets will all appear to chug along at the same level against the same backdrop. The level track is the ecliptic against the backdrop of the zodiac constellations. Seeing all planets spaced across the sky affords us a unique opportunity to appreciate the essential flatness of the solar system. For a beginner stargazer trying to make sense of how the planets orbit, a multi-body alignment beautifully illustrates the concept right before our eyes. Okay, I'm just going to knock it off the International Space Station. I don't know, I've seen it a couple of times. You haven't lived unless you've seen the International Space Station fly over your home and apartment at 27.6 thousand kilometres an hour. Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating a little, but not too much. 200 years ago, a giant spacecraft carrying men and women around the Earth every 90 minutes would have been unthinkable. Pure fantasy. Yet, there it is, a bright torch reminding us of what's possible with a little imagination or a lot of sweat. So, just to go on. With all the resources available, including websites, email alerts, and free mobile phone apps, I'll never be easier to spot the amazing man-made creation, the big satellite in the sky. Skyview light is absolutely essential. Oh, it's got a fair whack there, not being light here. As big as the US pro football field, including end zone, weighing 462 tons, equivalent of 237 mid-size SUVs, the space station circles the Earth at an average altitude of 248 miles, whatever that means. That may sound a long way from up there, but consider low Earth orbit, or LEO. Satellites at high Earth orbits, like those that relay communications around the globe, keep track of the weather, travel nearly 100 times higher. The station was designed to support a crew of six, but at a pinch, more souls can be accommodated. It smells like a sock, apparently. The fullest house of this writing is 13. When a 7-member crew from the space shuttle Endeavour docked with a 6-person crew aboard the ISS in July 2009. No matter when you spot the space station, you know there's likely to be a handful of astronauts aboard. It still can't get over the fact that every half hour and a half, our fellow human beings are speeding overhead at more than 22 times the speed of sound. As they hurry around the curve of the Earth, witnessing 16 sunsets and sunrise a day, astronauts run a host of science experiments in unique microgravity environment of the station. It's pretty much the same gravity as on Earth, but it's the fact that there's no differential gravity. They clean, check equipment, make repairs, prepare meals, conduct spacewalks to install equipment from outside the ISS to make repairs. Crew members must also exercise 2 hours a day to stay fit to prevent bone and muscle loss and loss that occur in a weightless environment. It's not all work. In their free time, astronauts can hang out in the multi-window cupola, a perfect place to read a book or gaze and take pictures of Earth below. Its 80-centimetre circular overhead window is the largest ever flown in space. Arrayed around it are six additional trapezoid-shaped windows. You'd have a hard time to getting me out of there. Just one more photo. Undoubtedly, you've seen pictures of astronauts floating around at the space station, launching themselves from the railing fixtures in their hands like fish might use fins. Weightlessness look like pure joy. The closest most of us come to the state is during sleep, when occasionally we dream of flying. Weightlessness is nothing to do with lack of gravity. The ISS remains in orbit thanks to the constant gravitational tug of the Earth below. Instead, it's all about falling. As it orbits, the space station is continuously falling towards the Earth. The reason it doesn't burn up in the atmosphere after a few orbits is because it's moving towards fast enough to swing around the curve of the globe without hitting the ground. Seen from the ISS, the Earth appears as a curve away from the ship at the same rate the ISS falls. Neither shall meet. Free falling, I love that one. Free fall causes weightlessness, but your mass, the stuff you carry around, remains the same. If you've ever been in an elevator and dropped too quickly to the next floor, you have felt lighter on your feet for a moment. That's a taste of weightlessness. Essentially, astronauts go about their work in a large, well-stocked, free-falling elevator. That is just a beautiful way of saying it. Congratulations, Astro Bob. You really have got that linguistic. Like many satellites, the ISS was launched from west to east to take advantage of the Earth's rotation. At Cape Canaveral's latitude, 28.5, the Earth spins at 1,471 kilometres an hour. That free boost means it takes less fuel to accelerate a satellite to orbital speed. Less fuel equals less cost. Closer to the equator, the Earth spins even faster and the bonus is bigger. Farther north, the Earth spins more slowly, completely zeroes out the poles, where there's no free launch. The launch direction directly affects where we look to see a pass. Without exception, the ISS first appears as a bright star somewhere in the western sky, whether it's southeast, due west, or northwest. From there, it travels east across the sky until it sets in the east and gets eclipsed by the Earth's shadow first. A complete pass lasts about 6 minutes. We see all satellites in a twilt of dark sky because they're high enough still to catch the rays of the sun after the sun. After the sun has set, observers on the ground, like the proverbial mountaintop, creeps higher and higher above the eastern horizon as the sun dips lower and lower below the western horizon. During a pass in a bright evening twilight, the ISS zips by and unbothered by the Earth's shadow. But 92 minutes later, when the shadow is climbed high enough, the sky to cover part of the station's path, something very interesting happens. Gaspy appears as west as usual, but a minute or two later it fades from view like a quenched spark, an eclipse from the Earth below. As the brightest man-made object in space, the space station normally reflects much more light than with smaller satellites, often outshining the planet Jupiter. Normally it shines with a steady light, appearing brightest during overhead passes because it's close as them, only about 250 miles. Directly or 400 kilometres directly above your nose. When it passes to the north or south directly overhead, when near the horizon, it appears fainter because you're looking off in the distance to see it, and farther away, the fainter it appears. Here are some fascinating things to watch for as it passes. Colour. The station looks pale yellow because the solar rays are insulated with gold-coloured foil called Captain. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. Captain is this plastic, which I get told off for being excited about it. Brightness. When it comes close overhead point, the ISS is only 200 or 400 kilometres from you. Absolutely brilliant. But when you first spot it, it's 1,400 away. Because of the added horizontal distance between you and the craft, the reason it looks fainted. Like the moon, the ISS goes through phases of angles between the station, the observer, and the sun changes. When low in the west, the station's edge is illuminated by the sun, just as the crescent moon. As it ascends, more giant structure gets lit up by the sun. When due south, it's roughly half moon, and it moves to the eastern side in waxing gibbous. The more it fills out, the brighter it gets to a point. Even though the station is nearly full when it descends to the east, it's further away, its brightness begins to fade. Flares. Due to sunlight reflecting off the solar panels, it sometimes looks like a sudden surge of brightness before it fades back to normal sunset. When the ISS is eclipsed by the Earth's shadow, the sun sets from the point of view from the astronaut crew. On the ground, we see the station quickly turn pale yellow to orange and red. Binoculars will show the colourful transition. Many must-see visits. Resupply tugs make regular runs to the space station. The Russian Soyuz spacecraft, at the last time of writing, ferries astronauts to and from the station. A cargo ship looks like a star, though it's not bright, that tracks along the space station until it docks. There's talk about deorbiting the space station sometime in the future, but Congress has extended the operation to 2024. What will happen beyond that date isn't certain, but there's discussion of transitioning the operation to private industry. There you go. Oh, Iridium Flare. Okay, well, I'll stop that. So that's on page number 25.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.